Hello, I'm Penelope Jenkins from the Knowledge Centre, and with me today is Dr. Anna Gerritsen from the Department of History, who is part of an international network researching global commodities. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
Global commodities, what does that mean exactly?
Well, it means all of the things that we have around us, so all of the objects that are part of our daily lives, that are part of our museum collections, that are part of the homes and family houses, the kind of grand homes of the National Trust, that are not just objects that came from here and are used here and have meaning here, but that have travelled in one way or another, so that have maybe come from further afield, that were maybe traded at some point, that were maybe produced somewhere else and now are used in our environment here. And if you think of that historically, you can imagine that that's something that, you know, that's been going on for a very long time. Mm-hmm. If you think about individual precious objects that travellers brought with them, or if you think of the production of goods in one part of the world and used somewhere else. And in that sense, of course, almost everything today is part of those kind of global networks, because, you know, there's very little now that's produced here and used here, right? Most things are either composite items that have been produced somewhere else and then transported and then added on. So global commodities are really the stuff, the things that are part of all the global flows of objects and people.
And how far back in history do you go with these commodities?
Well, I think it's almost limitless. You could almost go back to the earliest forms of archaeology and find objects that were traded or carried across. We don't actually, as part of our network, go back quite that far. We don't go back to the early origins of agriculture. In fact, we start around 1500, because that's the time that the amount of interaction, the amount of trade between different parts of the world significantly goes up. And that's in part because that's when the European trade companies are established and they set up quite formal ways of bringing commodities, particularly from the East, into Europe, but also they venture out into the Americas and bring crops and bring goods back and forth between the Americas and Europe. And we go up to about 1800 in this network, because really in the 19th century, when globalization becomes really intense and people really transport commodities very quickly over very vast distances, and trade becomes a real global institution, that takes it into quite a different level. So this is an early modern history project which looks at that particular period of 1500 to 1800.
And how did you and the university become involved in this network?
Well, we set it up, so that's how we became involved with it. I work on Chinese history, and I work particularly on the production of porcelain, which is something that was produced in China, and in fact the Chinese were the only ones who knew how to make porcelain, the actual quality of object that we call porcelain, which is fired earthenware at a very high temperature. No one else could make it, and as soon as people started to be aware of this, and that was already very early on in the Middle Ages, they already had these objects that had come from China. And in this period between 1500 and 1800, people became fascinated in Europe and started to trade, started to buy Chinese porcelain in very large quantities in China. My colleague, Giorgio Riello, who co-established this network with me, works on cotton particularly. And cotton was produced in India and was part of the kind of industrialization of Europe, built on techniques that came from India, and the trade between India and Europe is very much part of the huge growth of industrial development that characterizes the early modern world and into the Industrial Revolution. So the two of us do commodities, work on commodities that are global, and we established a network to bring together people in a number of different institutions in England, in Turkey, and in America to emphasize this more, to highlight the significance of these kind of commodities and the ways in which objects are part and should be seen as part of the interactions in the early modern world.
You mentioned that globalization had a great expansion in the 19th century, and of course we live in a globalized world today. So what relevance do you think your network has to 21st century culture?
Well, if you think of 21st century Britain and you think of the huge diversity of people we have in the country and the population is, as you know, it's a cliche, is multicultural, it's important, I think, to think of that not just as people moving, but as people bringing with them the objects that are meaningful to them and having access to objects around them that are part of a historical legacy. So if you think about the 21st century world as a world that is very diverse and full of migration and full of global interaction, it might seem slightly more alien and slightly more frightening if you think of that as a very contemporary development, something that we, you know, might have to be frightened of. You know, what is going on there? And I think it's meaningful to think that actually the exact same thing has been going on for hundreds of years. People have moved, objects have come with them, and we have around us, in the world around us, a legacy of that cultural interaction. And I think it's meaningful for example, the Chinese community in Britain, or the community of the various different Indian communities in Britain, to realize that it's not just a kind of 20th century development, or even a kind of something to do with the British Empire. Actually, there's a long history of interaction, and you can find, if you're a member of, say, you know, the Indian community living in Leamington Spa, you can go to one of the houses around us, you know, from that, for example, owned by the National Trust, and find objects of Indian background produced in India for people interested in India in, say, the 16th century, the 17th century. And I think that's part of explaining and understanding our very multicultural world today. It's not a recent thing. That has a long trajectory, and we should see it in that sense.
And how do you research and select the objects?
Well, quite a bit of it is done for us, of course, because these objects, a lot of the very precious objects and the really valuable and meaningful objects are in museum collections, and the Victoria and Albert Museum has tremendous collections of objects that are from other parts of the world, and the V&A is one of our partners in this network. But even if you go to, you know, much smaller museums, you can find collections. So in Bath, for example, there's a wonderful little museum of East Asian export art, and they have the most amazing collections of Chinese porcelain. Collected over centuries and put together in a wonderful small museum there. You can go to the Birmingham Museum and find lots of objects from India, from China, from other parts of the world, from the Americas. So some of the museum collections, the selection is done for us, and these are precious objects that are very worthwhile studying. But we're trying to expand that more and think also about the kind of objects that are in the grand houses around us. Some of my colleagues work on those kind of, you know, how did the collection of a National Trust house come to be so global? You know, why are all these objects in there, not just British, as we might think, but actually from other parts of the world? And we want to expand that even further and try and think about, you know, what objects do people have at home? What stories do they can they tell about these objects? And I would love to hear more from people. You know, what do you have in your collections? What is it? Is it something your grandmother left to you? Is that something an uncle brought from the Americas? Did somebody travel? Or is it just your own historical collection that you've collected over the years, objects that you brought from elsewhere? I think we can all relate to that. We all have stuff from other parts of the world, and we make it part of our own lives. And those are stories that are worth thinking about.
You gave a talk recently at a symposium on the material world, the art, and the culture of global connections.
I did, yes. Well, so this is part of our network, and this was an event that took place in a museum just outside Boston in Salem, the PBD Essex Museum. And we brought together for this symposium people who work on global material culture in all kinds of parts of the world and in all kinds of different connections. So not just Europe and Asia, but the Americas, South America, the connections between, say, Mexico and China. I mean, who knew that in Mexico there were extraordinary collections of silk and porcelain that came from China? There were large Chinese communities living in Mexico City, for example, that people in New Mexico, so in the southern United States, had amazing collections of objects that came from China. Very often people didn't quite know what they were. Similarly, objects traded through the Pacifics, precious objects that came from animals that people didn't know about, raincoats made of the guts of sea animals, extraordinary objects that we know very little about. So we had specialists who could elucidate these objects, who could talk about them and say, look how integrated this early modern world was. We had talks right through the day, and at the end of the day, my challenge was to try and bring it all together and to make draw some kind of conclusion from all that. And of course, the obvious conclusion is to say the early modern world was connected. But I tried to think about that a little bit more, and the way I did that is by focusing on one particular object. And the object was something that was in the collection actually at the Peabody Essex Museum, and it was a small statue about 9 inches high, and it features a small odd-looking man with a small head sitting on top of two legs, dressed in bulky trousers. And actually, I mean, when you first look at it, it just looks slightly monstrous, and you can't quite make out what it is. And what it turns out to be is a depiction, a little statue, depicting somebody called Mr. Nobody, and it's a man without a body. And it was actually modelled after a play, and it was a kind of satirical play from the early 17th century about Mr. Nobody, who was in competition with Mr. Somebody, and Mr. Somebody complained that nobody got all this attention because everyone was always saying, nobody is clearing up the mess here, nobody has taken care of the drunks in the street, nobody is doing anything about this. And Mr. Somebody said, why is Mr. Nobody getting all this attention? Anyway, so it's a sort of 17th century amusing play, and this is a depiction of Mr. Nobody, literally a statue with a head and two legs but no body. So it's a kind of pun that makes sense in the English language. But oddly, the statue was made in China. So it's a Chinese depiction of something that means nothing to the Chinese. You can imagine to try and explain in the 17th century to a potter working in this small town in China what the joke is about this figure without any legs. But it was quite common by then, by the early 17th century, for potters in China to make objects that were just made to order by Europeans, and whether these were little statues that were part of a play and an in-joke amongst the British traders, or whether it was maybe a fine porcelain cup that depicted the arms, the coat of arms of a Portuguese ruler, or later on in the course of the 17th century, lots of people in England and also in Holland and in France ordered to have their crest, their coat of arms for their family, made to order in China, and have a whole dinner set of these objects made for use in Britain. So the little statue that I talked about seemed to me a perfect example of this kind of interaction that's actually not just about having an object that was made elsewhere and having the enjoyment of having something that is exotic or different, but actually having a relationship that is so deeply ingrained that you can go and set up an interaction that says, I want you to make this object, and it means nothing to you, but it means something to me, and I want it to look like this. And what you can, once you understand the complexities of that, so the existence of these networks of potters working in China to produce these things for markets very far away, you can see the kind of complexities of that and the subtlety. So the ways in which the Chinese added little elements that were meaningful to the Chinese, because, of course, when they were producing something, when they were looking at material culture, they had certain expectations of what an object should be like and what the decorative elements meant. And what you can do when you study material culture, so material culture is objects, but also objects in context and thinking about the meaning of those objects, what you can do once you start to study material culture is to think about how much understanding was there really and how much communication was there between the two ends here, and how much how much integration can we find? And in fact, of course, there are limits to it, because the Chinese, you know, they certainly won't have understood what Mr. Nobody was about, and there are famous misunderstandings about logos or, you know, the coat of arms made for family that were made slightly wrong or something gone slightly pear-shaped in the communication there. But on the whole, you know, if you think about the production in China, they were making extraordinary objects for a wide range of markets. So they could target objects specifically for European markets. So they could distinguish between the different markets, and they could make something for the Dutch market, they could make something for the English market, they could make something slightly different again for the American market, and undoubtedly different again for the Mexican or the South American market. And the sophistication of that differentiation, and that's just the part that I know about, you know, because I work on Chinese history and I know the ways in which these potters were learning about these differences, you begin to see that this is not just an early modern world where people had objects from different parts of the world, but where people really had quite a lot of knowledge about what this wider world was like, and who saw themselves not just as individuals in their own location, their own home in, let's say, in the middle of Britain, but they could see themselves as part of much wider integrations and communications. And I think that's something we can really use as a kind of inspiration for today's world too.
We've got a picture in the studio of Mr. Nobody, and he's got a fascinating beard there, hasn't he? He does look a little bit Chinese, his face.
Yeah, I mean, there are sort of characteristics that are really Chinese about this. He's also got a kind of floral pattern on his sleeves with little flowery decorations, which look more Chinese to me than anything else. But then he's holding these, a cup and a small pot with a spout on it, which are undoubtedly drinking implements. And the Chinese wouldn't drink beer or wine in that particular way. It's also the blue and white of the porcelain of this object is something that was developed in China already in the 13th century, in fact, and it was a white surface that's particularly white because of the clays that were found in Jingdezhen, in this part of China. Nowhere else really until quite late could make something that was so white in surface. And then they had this blue decoration on it, which is cobalt, and that comes from the Middle East. It's produced in mines in Iran and was traded as part of the Mongol interactions in the early modern in the world. So the Mongols brought this cobalt to China and set up these and instituted these decorations that were blue patterns on white backgrounds that became a really catchy combination that took off globally. I mean, it was a real early global brand. And it meant that people in Europe also started to produce things that were blue and white. And the European potters, these early 17th century potters working, for example, in Delft in Holland and in Southwark in London, they were producing a similar kind of blue and white ware inspired by what the Chinese were producing, but couldn't quite find the right ingredients to have the white surface. So the white surface had to be painted on with a kind of tin glaze to make it look white on top of what was actually quite a reddish earthenware base, and that already didn't look quite as good as what the Chinese were producing. And they too had to trade elsewhere to get the cobalt, most likely the European version, because we have a European version of this statue too, was decorated with blue that was imported from Saxony, from Central Europe. So, you know, even in what was produced within the European context, relied on trade and interaction throughout Europe much more widely. And we know we're beginning to see much more how all of the production of material culture, including art and painting, and how, you know, these objects were all reliant on interactions and negotiations and communications that crossed cultural boundaries, linguistic boundaries, and quite different environments, but created a very mixed interaction.
Well, thank you, Anna. That's fascinating. But I'm afraid we've run out of time now, so we're going to have to leave our discussion and Mr. Nobody there. Do come back and see what we're up to on the Knowledge Centre, as we'll be updating the site regularly with latest research and learning materials.